You know what? Morning meetings.
Thursday, March 1st, 2001, 1 p.m., Hearing Room E, House Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs.
The House Business and Labor Committee is March 1st. And we have three bills up today. If you came and are here for 2744, there was a revised agenda as of about a week ago, and we will not be hearing that bill. So if you're here for that reason, you can be excused. Otherwise, your bill should come up today. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2196 and our new, well, maybe not new.
New and improved. Well, actually, this is my my first meeting as a committee.
First meeting as a committee.
All right.
There could be some hazing for that. We don't know what it is yet. But anyway, Patrick Brennan, tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2196 expands authority of the Landscape Architects Board to require registration of persons performing landscape architecture and related activities. It requires a landscape architecture work done for a public works project to be done by a registered landscape architect, defines landscape architecture. The bill authorizes the board to require continuing education as a condition of for renewal of registration. It authorizes the board to require disclosure of non-registrant status by landscape designers, provides for confidentiality of examinations, reference letters, and investigative information developed and maintained by the board. It authorizes the board to compel compliance with board subpoenas. The bill increases the size of the board from 5 to 7 by adding 2 registered landscape architects, provides a variety of sanctions and criminal penalties, including fines of not more than $5,000 and imprisonment of not more than 6 months for violation of any statutory provision or administrative rule of the board.
Thank you. First up, we got Jim Figurski. That's close. It's not quite right, though. Stephen Kafori. And anyone else?
I have 2 other people, Mr. Chair.
2 other? You got 4 seats?
I've bunched together. We'll have 4 seats.
Go for it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Kafori. This afternoon I'm representing the Oregon chapter of the American Society of Landscape Architects. And I have with me Jim Figurski, who is the chair of the Oregon Landscape Architects Board, Marcia Argist, who is the director of public affairs for the national organization, American Landscape Architects, American Society of Landscape Architects, and Paul Morris, who is past president of the Oregon chapter and presently the vice president of the national organization. And Jim would like to go first.
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Jim Figurski. I am a licensed landscape architect in Oregon. I've been licensed for 16 years. I am the current chair of the Oregon Landscape Architects Board. I've been chair of the board for about 5 years. I've been on the board a total of about 7. Want to start with a little bit of history and general information, I'll be as brief as possible, and if there are questions, please feel free to ask. The licensure has been established in Oregon and has been almost continuously in Oregon since 1965. There has been some form or format of licensure for landscape architects. Currently, there are 46 states, 2 U.S. territories, and 2 Canadian provinces that have licensure for landscape architects as a requirement. And of those, approximately 28 have practice acts, the requirement for practice. We're here today because of work that has started over a year and a half ago. We started in July of 1999 by answering a call from the Landscape Contractors Board to come testify during an issue of enforcement. During the course of that hearing, there were discussions about the roles of landscape designers, the roles of landscape contractors, and the roles of landscape architects in the design profession. And what came out of that was that there were some unclarity and some fuzziness about what each of us do and what each of us is allowed to do by law and whether or not certain individuals should be regulated. We agreed at that point during that hearing to form a subcommittee or task force, if you will. That task force included members from the Landscape Contractors Board. It included members of the Association of Northwest Landscape Designers. It included myself as chair of the Landscape Architects Board, and it included members from the American Society of Landscape Architects. We worked for over a year in crafting a draft practice act. That draft was based on a national model law. There is a national organization of licensing boards. It was based on that model, and in addition, it was based on current statutes, practice statutes, that exist in neighboring states, California, Nevada, Arizona, and others. We looked at all of those, crafted this language. We worked with the various organizations, crafted the language. We had our Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General assigned to our board, look at the language, correct it, talk to us about the legalities of certain points, and came up with a final draft. That draft we then took around to many of our allied organizations. We went back to the Landscape Contractors Board, presented them with the draft. They voted to support it. We took it to the Association of Northwest Landscape Designers, presented it to them. They voted to support it. We took it to the Oregon Architects Board, presented it to them, discussed it with them. They agreed to support it and voted to support it. We took it to the Oregon chapter of the American Institute of Architects and discussed it in length with them, and they voted to support it. We have talked to other collateral organizations as well, and although none of them have taken formal votes at this point, there is other support for the bill. The draft was finished approximately last August. During that time, as I said, we went around. It was then submitted through legal counsel for the process that took it here, and legal counsel for the legislature assured me that I would not recognize it by the time it got into its final draft. So if you ask me specific questions about the bill and it takes me a minute to find it in its current form, bear with me, because it has changed considerably in orientation of certain portions. I want to talk a little bit about the reasons for a practice act versus a title act and what that difference is. Right now, Oregon has what is called a strong title act, and that all it regulates is the use of the title landscape architect or landscape architecture. It allows anyone otherwise to pursue the same sort of work and to perform the same sort of services as a licensed landscape architect in this state, as long as they do not call themselves a landscape architect. As a board member, as chair of the board, who is charged by the state to protect health, safety, and welfare, we feel this puts the public at risk, that there's an uncertainty, that there's no definition as to the credentials or credibility or experience level of the person then engaging this work. A practice act establishes written, measurable set of standards, including a code of professional conduct that guarantees the public a certain minimal quality of product. It also establishes a direct link of liability. It also establishes the ability for the board and for the profession to regulate itself. Currently, as a title act only, we can only enforce misuse of the title. In my tenure on the board, there have been at least a half dozen occasions where instances have been brought to us from the private sector, from clients, from other professionals for action, and we have had to turn them away because we're not allowed to deal with malpractice or any sort of fraud or fraudulent acts as the board. We can only deal with the title infringements. The Practice Act, through its examination, also sets up that minimum testing and educational experience. And there is a difference between the different professions. Landscape architecture and the board at this point is not asking for special status in this regard. A practice act puts us in the same status and gives us the same ability as the other design professions, architects, engineers, land surveyors, to regulate their profession. All of them have practice regulations and have the ability to regulate and enforce their profession. What does this Practice Act do in its actuality? First, let me tell you what it doesn't do. It doesn't restrict the practice of landscape design or garden design or whatever type of design you want to call it. As long as the public's health, safety, and welfare is not at risk. And we worked over that year to craft that line, or at the time we called it a hole, and we were trying to define whether or not you fit in the hole or whether you fell outside of the hole, and where public health, safety, and welfare was. And we came up with language that addressed conceptual design as being not significantly affecting the public health, safety, and welfare. That as a designer, you were perfectly entitled, and this bill keeps that right, to provide what is called conceptual design within the practice, within the statute. And let me explain a little bit about what conceptual design means in terms of this proposal. It means that a designer, an individual, a contract, whomever, can prepare plans and drawings that locate plant materials, locate hardscape elements, pavings, decks, structures, gazebos, water features. They can prepare drawings that would present those elements in terms of the scale and relationship of items within a site. They could do any sort of drawing that they needed to communicate the idea. Where that individual would cross the line would be at the point that they begin to recommend specific installation, construction, techniques. As an example, you might consider a deck or a concrete pad within a landscape, a patio, that the landscape designer or a designer depicts as being flagstone or bluestone, stone of a certain size, stone with joints of a certain dimension, this plaza or patio has a certain scale. All of that is still conceptual. Where it crosses a line would be when the individual starts to say, the stone needs to be this thick. The underlayment needs to be this thick. For structural reasons, the mortar bonding the stone has to be a type N or a type S. And that the pad below that mortar that supports it has to be concrete of a certain thickness, and it has to have a welded wire mesh within it. That's technical information that the public needs some assurance that the person making those recommendations has been certified as qualified to make those selections and to make that distinction. It does not affect landscape contractors. At this point, landscape contractors can continue to provide the types of design services that their statutes allow, because landscape contractors are tested and certified for their skills and abilities in a fashion, you know, similar to what landscape architects are, although maybe not as extensive. So there is a process in place for landscape contractors. Again, I, as I would say, I just remind the committee that this has been a collaborative effort. We have what we feel is a good bill. The language may not be 100% perfect, but we think it works. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Marcia Argus, and I'm the Director of Public and Government Affairs at the American Society of Landscape Architects. We're the only national professional society representing over 30,000 landscape architects. I want to thank the members of the committee for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 2196, which we wholeheartedly endorse. Specifically, I want to address today the process involved with becoming a registered landscape architect. The intensive education, experience, and examination requirements that a landscape architect must meet are equal to that required by other design professions, and they clearly demonstrate that landscape architecture is a highly technical and comprehensive profession that should be regulated by a practice act. To become registered in landscape architecture, an individual must first receive a formal education. A typical accredited program focuses on natural and social systems, planning, design, plants and ecosystems, mathematical and biological sciences, and professional practice methods. Students complete a 4 to 5 year undergraduate degree program, and many individuals go on to obtain a 2 or 3 year master's degree. A significant aspect of the landscape architecture education program is the design studio requirement. During studio, students learn to integrate the subject matter they've learned in lectures. These studios are essential for teaching students how to analyze data from numerous systems and synthesize this information to problem solve complex issues in the working world. After graduating, an individual must receive practical experience under the supervision of a licensed or registered professional. This training period is set by law, and including the education period, it can total up to 7 to 8 years in Oregon. After acquiring this experience, to become registered, an individual must pass the Landscape Architect Registration Examination, or the LARE. This rigorous 3-day exam tests the specific skills necessary for a landscape architect to be minimally competent in professional practice and the protection of the public health, safety, and welfare. Specifically, the LARE evaluates an individual's knowledge of the legal aspects of business, their analytical capabilities, preparation and ability to communicate through conceptual diagrams and graphics, design skills, obviously, and understanding of materials and construction, as well as the very technical skills involved in grading, drainage, and stormwater management. According to an independent audit conducted by the Educational Testing Service, a respected testing consultant, the LARE meets or exceeds all nationally recognized testing standards. After successfully accomplishing, or perhaps I should say enduring, this entire process of education, experience, and examination, an individual has met the minimum competency requirements to practice landscape architecture. There are several national organizations I want to mention that exist to ensure that this process adheres to the highest standards. The American Society of Landscape Architects, which was formed in 1899, provides LARE preparatory opportunities as well as many continuing education classes. The Landscape Architectural Accreditation Board is a specialized agency that accredits landscape architecture educational programs leading to professional degrees at the bachelor or master's level. In addition to assessing how well a program meets its own educational objectives, accreditation also evaluates a program against the standards of the profession. And finally, the Council of Landscape Architecture Registration Boards, or CLARB, develops and administers the LARE, including the extremely thorough grading process conducted by master graders with extensive experience. Every 5 years, CLARB surveys the profession to determine the knowledge and skills used in everyday practice. This information is used to ensure that the exam reflects and tests the appropriate skills. The link between landscape architecture and the protection of public health, safety, and welfare is clear. Upgrading Oregon's Title Act to a Practice Act is necessary to ensure the public that practicing landscape architects have successfully undergone the comprehensive and technical training necessary to demonstrate minimal competency. And in closing, as the representative for ASLA National, I just want to reiterate that regulation of landscape architecture continues to grow at the national level. Over the past 10 years, 18 states have adopted or upgraded licensing laws, and none of these laws have been repealed during this time. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think if we could just continue with the testimony, and if we have questions, we'll take it when the panel's done.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Morris. I am a registered landscape architect in the state of Oregon. I'm actually a native Oregonian and graduated from the University of Oregon with a baccalaureate in landscape architecture. For the last almost 20 years, I've been practicing landscape architecture in the state, and during that time, I have been registered for approximately 16 years. As a special area of practice that I have been involved in over the last 10 years, I have been asked to serve as an expert witness and mediator in cases involving third-party claims from insurance companies, lawsuits involving faulty design, and arbitrations. And that has provided me with a unique perspective, I suppose, as to the nature in which projects occur and the way they're played out in the field. I'm here on behalf of not only myself as a registrant, but on behalf of the many landscape architects in Oregon who are members of the American Society of Landscape Architects as well, having been a chapter president and a trustee before becoming a national vice president a year ago. Over the time that I've been practicing, it's taught me a lot about the practice that we participate in and the distinctions between the contracting community, the design community, and the landscape architects per se. And one of the reasons I've been asked to talk to you today is to provide you perhaps a little bit of perspective and maybe a little more information on the scope and nature of our practice, and maybe to also add a few more morsels of information as to the kinds of issues involving the public health and safety that we confront as a profession. To do that, I'm going to ask if we could to just provide members of the committee, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, with a copy of a brochure that outlines kind of the broader scope of landscape architecture, which, as you will see in the bill and you have heard from both Jim Figurski and Marcia Argus, involves a broad range of skill sets ranging all the way from large-scale land use and master planning, feasibility studies, and other design issues down to planning, design, irrigation, grading and drainage, stormwater quality, erosion control, construction drawings and specifications, cost estimates, and even construction observation. The kinds of projects that our professional members are typically involved in, you all experience on a daily basis. So this is the kind of thing that comes right home to you. And I'm proud to be able to say that we're sitting in a building that's on the grounds of one of the more notable landscapes in our state, Capitol Grounds, which was, in fact, a site designed by a registered landscape architect. Some of you are familiar with the Oregon Garden, located in Silverton, Oregon, which is envisioned over the next 20 years to be a world-class display garden. I think what is unique about that that you may not know is that that garden actually is a wastewater treatment facility for the city of Silverton's wastewater treatment plant. And that work required exceptional understanding of the technicalities involved in wastewater management. In addition to that, we've been involved in numerous parks and playgrounds and other kind of conventional things that you're all familiar with. What I'd like to do real quickly, if I may, is show you a brief slideshow. There's only about 15 or 17 slides, but it might help provide what admittedly is an incomplete picture of some of the work that landscape architects are performing these days, and perhaps even provide you with a little more insight as to some of the issues that we confront. If that's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll proceed. I'm going to have a remote slide control here of the human variety, so if we could turn the light on. I think our light controller, there we go. One of the things that we find ourselves increasingly involved in around the state are the integration of transportation systems in public venues where pedestrians, bicyclists, and automobiles are interacting. Very clearly an issue in which we're dealing with public safety at its very core. In addition to that, this particular slide that you're looking at is actually of the new light rail transit station at the Oregon Zoo in Portland. Not only is this a unique setting, but there are a lot of other things that go along with it, most notably the fact that it is at the second most frequently visited tourist destination in our state, the zoo itself, which was designed by registered landscape architects. The next slide I'm going to show you is of Lewis and Clark College. Campus planning is a very common practice of many landscape architects. What's unique about campus planning today is that it has moved away from the traditional institutional construct and is now much more focusing on integrating the built environment with natural settings. A very complex issue involving natural habitat for wildlife, as well as the ability to integrate stormwater quality into the landscape. The third slide is out of focus, heading in the wrong direction, is over in the Hood River National area, U.S. Forest area, and the image here is depicting what is becoming very popular, and that is the integration of recreation and educational facilities into the natural landscape for educational purposes, interpretive facilities, that sort of thing. The next slide is of a canal area. The canal area open space plan. And this is one thing that many people think of landscape architects doing, large-scale parks and recreation master planning. I had the privilege of actually getting to do the parks and rec plan for the city of Salem, and that's something that many of us do. That is an ongoing thing for many of our practitioners, not only of parks and open space, but of natural area restoration work. The next slide looks at another area of large-scale master planning, which is the Washington Park Regional Town Center project, where we're dealing with both urban development, integration of major transportation systems with large-scale compact urban growth, as well as dealing with redevelopment strategies on an economic side. The next slide is along the Willamette River, in an area that many people don't realize landscape architects play a major role. Many landscape architects specialize in waterfront development and marina design, an area that has been of particular interest to folks over the last several years as we've dealt with flooding and other kinds of issues. This is one area where I personally have actually spent a fair amount of time doing third-party claims for faulty marine design projects because they failed during those floods. The next slide, similar in nature, begins to look at the notion of how we design simple structures such as decks and boardwalks to provide a way for people to have access to these waterways in a safe environment, knowing that we have to account for what is everywhere from a 10 to 100-year flood regime. The next slide looks at the South Waterfront, and this is an area that is a redevelopment area of the downtown Portland. It is actually being shown here to show that many landscape architects, while they are perceived over the years to be garden designers, also design public plazas and parks, and in this case even are involved in the design of residential housing on the urban scale. The next slide goes back over to the Hood River and Moser area and is of an actual slide of the Hatfield Trailhead, which is a part of an actual quarry reclamation, which is happening more often. A major issue that we deal with on a wide scale. The next slide looks back at the local scale and deals at the neighborhood level. As we see states around the country trying to grapple with maintaining and enhancing their quality of life, this whole notion of what we call livable communities is becoming a popular phrase. Many landscape architects are taking lead roles in the United States to help communities define livable communities at the neighborhood scale, the community scale, and the regional scale. This is a Renko Station, a nationally award-winning project designed by landscape architects. And then finally, the final image is of what's called the Center Commons, a transit-oriented development along Interstate 84 that integrates affordable housing with market-rate housing and in a very compact urban scale that supports both seniors and families in a very quality-oriented environment. The next five or six slides kind of take a little different turn and begin to look at what some of those issues are that become the public safety. The first one is the Tualatin Hills Nature Park. And while on the surface this might seem like a fairly benign, uninteresting, and non-threatening environment, what's critical about this is that landscape architects are daily involved in the design and restoration of wetlands for both water quality, wildlife habitat, and stormwater management. They're not only doing it to create the ability for us to continue to develop in a safe way, but also they're doing it, as I mentioned at the outset, to deal with things like wastewater, which is a much more complex issue. The next slide looks back at the zoo station and takes a look at the Les Aucoin Plaza. On the face of this one, everyone gets nervous when they see all those kids crawling around the rocks, but believe it or not, substantial efforts were taken to actually design this in a way that was actually safe and secure for kids to actually play on. Some of the subtleties you'll see there is that while you see those retaining walls in stone, all of the surface around that is crushed stone. So so that when kids actually jump off the stones, they're into a soft surface. It keeps them from getting hurt, and if they fell, they'd actually hit that rather than a concrete or paved area. The next slide looks at Gresham Main City Park. And this is a park project that was designed in the 60s. It's been heavily used to the point where it's been overused, and now, as a part of the ESA listings, the endangered species listings, and also flood issues along the Johnson Creek watershed, our firm and another firm, actually several other firms, combined together, several landscape architects and other professionals, to reconstruct and hundred-year flood regime. The next slide looks at the South Waterfront, and this is an area that is a redevelopment area of the downtown Portland. It is actually being shown here to show that many landscape architects, while they are perceived over the years to be garden designers, also design public plazas and parks, and in this case even are involved in the design of residential housing on the urban scale. The next slide goes back over to the Hood River and Moser area and is of an actual slide of the Hatfield Trailhead, which is a part of an actual quarry reclamation, which is happening more often, a major issue that we deal with on a wide scale. The next slide looks back at the local scale and deals at the neighborhood level. As we see states around the country trying to grapple with maintaining and enhancing their quality of life, this whole notion of what we call livable communities is becoming a popular phrase. Many landscape architects are taking lead roles in the United States to help communities define livable communities at the neighborhood scale, community scale, and the regional scale. This is a Renko Station, a nationally award-winning project designed by landscape architects. And then finally, the final image is of what's called the Center Commons, a transit-oriented development along Interstate 84 that integrates affordable housing with market-rate housing and in a very compact urban scale that supports both seniors and families in a very quality-oriented environment. The next five or six slides kind of take a little different turn and begin to look at what some of those issues are that become the public safety. The first one is the Tualatin Hills Nature Park. And while on the surface this might seem like a fairly benign, uninteresting, and non-threatening environment, what's critical about this is that landscape architects are daily involved in the design and restoration of wetlands for both water quality, wildlife habitat, and stormwater management. They're not only doing it to create the ability for us to continue to develop in a safe way, but also they're doing it, as I mentioned at the outset, to deal with things like wastewater, which is a much more complex issue. The next slide looks back at the zoo station and takes a look at the Les Aucoin Plaza. On the face of this one, everyone gets nervous when they see all those kids crawling around the rocks, but believe it or not, substantial efforts were taken to actually design this in a way that was actually safe and secure for kids to actually play on. Some of the subtleties you'll see there is that while you see those retaining walls in stone, all of the surface around that is crushed stone, so that when kids actually jump off the stones, they're into a soft surface. It keeps them from getting hurt, and if they fell, they'd actually hit that rather than a concrete or paved area. The next slide looks at Gresham Main City Park. And this is a park project that was designed in the 60s. It's been heavily used to the point where it's been overused, and now, as a part of the ESA listings, the endangered species listings, and also flood issues along the Johnson Creek watershed, our firm and another firm, actually several other firms, combined together, several landscape architects and other professionals, to reconstruct and redesign this park so that it would meet the needs of that community for recreation while combining the needs of flood control and wildlife habitat restoration. So a really tough problem that required a lot of thought. The next slide gets at an issue that we often forget until we have major rains, and that's soil erosion, hillside management, and landslide issues. Daily, landscape architects are involved in projects on hillsides, and as we look at a lot of our communities where people are looking more and more toward trying to find ways to develop in sloped conditions, it becomes more and more critical to be able to understand the technologies involved in making those safe environments. And so that is an issue that we are always dealing with. The next slide looks again back at Orenco Station. And this particular image is of a streetscape design, a main street. And many landscape architects around the state of Oregon are working with local communities at the rural and urban scale to rebuild their main streets, to make them more safe, more pedestrian-friendly, and more economically viable areas. Those are things that also involve the public safety on a daily basis. And then finally, back to the Center Commons. This project, what's unique about this is the fact that it does provide for families to live there, and in particular, playground areas for kids. This is something that for many, many years, landscape architects have specialized in, and that's parks and playgrounds. And it is a huge area of critical liability and concern because we're dealing with children on a daily basis. So these give you a basic idea of the range of landscape architectural services that are often practiced by landscape architects around the state of Oregon. These are not unusual. They certainly aren't the full story of what they do, but they hopefully will give you somewhat of a flavor for what we are dealing with. And what the bill that the board has put together seeks to try to help clarify. The members of our chapter here in Oregon, and I personally have had an opportunity over the last year and a half while the board was working on this, to be able to participate and see what they are drafting and provide our comments. And we do support this. We believe that it provides much greater clarity to our consumer clients. It provides much more certainty to them about when they are hiring someone that they're getting a qualified professional. And over time, it will also gradually increase the assurances of safety in all the work that we do. With that, I thank you for your time, and I think at this point we perhaps are ready for questions you might have, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Kafouri, I appreciate very much having copies of written testimony. It means everything, I think, to us, and I hope you'll put your good words into good writing, because there's no way on earth that I can remember information like this that I'm really unfamiliar with. If you don't mind, I'd be grateful. I would like to refer to page 8 of your bill. And just two concerns. Of course, I realize that this bill probably has a physical impact on state agencies. One question. Would you agree?
The question was
fiscal impact
on state agencies?
Or state.
Well, yeah.
State.
Yeah. The state, period, I will just say.
I don't believe that it has a significant impact on the state. Our board is 100% self-sufficient. We are one of the original boards that was granted semi-independent status. The only costs involved with licensing at this point are the application to take the exam. In terms of a cost to consumer, I don't believe that there is an added cost to consumers, because it still allows other people to provide design services at a scale that the average consumer typically uses already and does not take that away. I'm not sure if I've answered the exact point of your question, but I'd be happy to follow up if I've missed the point.
Representative Nelson, we do not have a fiscal on this yet because we're only having a public hearing today, but to get maybe to the point, depending on how many people you throw in jail,
that's right,
your 6 months imprisonment, it could have a potential impact on, for instance, the corrections department. So therefore, we will order a fiscal if we take this to work session.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Anyway, but I see there's tremendous legal implications in this bill. And to me, I would feel better if I had the Judicial Committee look at this, because there's tremendous fines and sanctions. on previous other pages about my level. But anyway, back on down to on page 8. the way I read Section 17 is that, beginning with line 24, where it says, drawings, plans, specifications, estimates, and construction observation for public works of the state. I'm assuming that means all public works. Or a political subdivision. I'm assuming that means of the state. That involve landscape architecture must be, this is a mandate, be prepared by or under the direct supervision of a landscape architect registered in an appropriate category. So to me that, I mean, that has a fiscal impact as long as well as a, you know, unfunded mandate. Is that how you read that? Mr. Morris or Ms. Argus or Mr. Podurski?
Podurski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think what the intent of that particular clause in Section 17 is meant to address is any time a public agency requests professional services on a project that require the level of expertise that a landscape architect would be granted under this bill, they would be obligated to retain one who is in fact registered to do so. So it, many of them already do that on most projects because they require seals on the final construction drawings, and without being registered, you can't have a seal or a stamp to do so. So what it does is it provides clarity to the procurement process for services involving those types of projects that affect the public health and safety at a public level. Is that accurate?
Follow up, Mr. Chair, please.
Follow up.
So the way I read this, one more time, says these plans and so forth must be prepared by or under the direct supervision of. So to me this means that any building construction plan whatsoever has to absolutely, I mean with it, no matter what, we have a landscape architect involved. That's how it, public works.
Right.
Yeah.
Of any sort has to have this. I mean, that's the way I read that one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, if I may clarify this, Section 17 is basically a clarification of an already existing statute. The statute language right now, and as you see in the brackets, it says any political subdivision, and the old language, you know, therein, the contract shall be only. What we've tried to do in this section is clarify the language of what is expected, and it is only regards to landscape architectural services or projects. The statutes currently, in their current configuration, the way the State Attorney General or our Assistant Attorney General has consistently interpreted them for us, is that political subdivisions are already required when doing public work to contract in terms of landscape architecture with licensed professionals. And again, this is a clarification of the extent of that contract, that it extends to drawings, plans, specifications, etc., and that it is really nothing new, but more of an expansion and clarification of what the original language meant.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. Podurski, aren't lines 24 and 27 to 27 brand new insertions?
They are brand new insertions, Representative Nelson, Mr. Chair. They were added as clarification to the existing language. Again, this language for this proposed practice act is based on our national model. The national model uses language of this sort to clarify that intent. And that language was added with the intention of clarification. We don't believe it changes the impact of the statute for this particular section.
Follow up, please. So, Mr. Podurski, apologize. Should there not be a clause in here for an exemption? Because there's bound to be some public works that would not require a landscape architect, right?
Can I?
Yeah. I just don't see any exemptive. I mean, it just seems like anything we're going to do. Do you see what I'm saying, Mr. Morris?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, if you might indulge me and step back to Clause 1 in that statement, what it says is the state or any political subdivision may contract with or landscape architectural services projects only with a registered landscape architect as defined in it. Section 2 describes the responsibilities of that work being then done by a registered landscape architect. Intent is to describe the nature of the work that is being done, which didn't exist before.
Mr. Chair, may I take a stab at it? I think if you look on page 25, Mr. Chair, line, page 8, line 25, okay. Drawings, plans, specifications that involve landscape architecture. So if you were building and there's no landscape architecture, you wouldn't hire a landscape architect. Only if there's a building you're building that is surrounded by landscape that you need to hire a that involves landscape architecture, then you need to hire a landscape architect.
Thank you, Mr. Kukuni. I think, Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify what I'm... I guess what I'm trying to understand, Mr. Kafori, is that the definition of what requires landscape architecture is, according to this, with all the different sanctions and fines and penalties, is in the eyes of the landscape architect. Not in the eyes of the person conducting the or getting prepared to construct a new facility or any other type of public work. Who decides that is my question. I mean, by this, I don't see that there's an exemption for whoever's administering a public work or handling the arrangements, the project, has to not use these services in any form. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, at the beginning when we were talking here earlier in the bill about what the definition of landscape architecture is, it defines very clearly the kind of things that landscape architects do and what they don't do. So if a person wanted to design a building for the city of Medford and they wanted to put some grass outside, they would take a look in the bill and say, is putting grass outside a building in the realm of landscape architect design or not? And the other parts of the bill tell whether that would be or whether it would not be. So it isn't up into anybody's mind. There's no subjectivity here at all. It's very clear that there are certain tasks that need to be done by our landscape architects. Certain tasks do not need to be. We don't make that decision. The person who's hiring it from the city of Medford, he doesn't make that decision. The only person to make that decision is the person who's reading this bill. And we think it makes a very clear distinction between those projects that do require landscape architecture and those that don't require landscape architecture.
Representative Wilson.
Did that answer your question? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the beautiful work that you do. Question that I have, though, is in testimony a few moments ago, you mentioned that... You mentioned the reasons for this bill, and they seem to be generally prospective, things that you don't want to see happen and things that you want people to be assured of in the future. The question I would have at this point is, what has happened in the past that has led to the need for the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I think as I may have sped through maybe too fast in my initial testimony, there have been instances over my term on the board of landscape architects. As I think I said, there have been approximately a half dozen instances over that time where allegations of misconduct, malpractice, fraud have been brought to the board. But because we only have a title act, we are unable to act or take any action in terms of making a determination or the complaining party as to whether anything exists to take any remedy, any enforcement action to cause that person to cease and desist from continuing to take those actions or provide those services without adequate care and knowledge. Right now, we can't do that. We cannot stop somebody who is unqualified to attempt a certain level of design from attempting that certain level of design. And it is pretty much, buyer beware. The consumer is left guessing as to whether or not that person is really qualified to do that work or not.
Representative Wilson, also at the national level, there certainly are case-specific situations where there has been harm done, whether it's playgrounds or urban parks that haven't been designed properly to prevent crime, issues like that that have come up all across the nation.
If I could add just maybe a couple other comments, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, the problem with not having a practice act is that the Landscape Architects Board never knows that when there is a case in which there is a cause for malpractice, they can't go to the board because the board does not have the authority to honor their request. Therefore, they really have only one or two options, either to accept the outcome or, if they have the financial resources, ultimately to take it to a civil court. And for me personally, that's involved serving as an expert witness on many cases over the last 15 to 20 years involving designs of parking lots in which people's, broke their legs. Recently, I was involved in a case in which somebody had, a landscape designer, had been hired by a residential homeowner to do their backyard. Now, that sounds like a pretty straightforward project. The problem was it was in Forest Heights. For those who know the Portland area, Forest Heights comes with the knowing that it is in a hillside condition. And they gave design plans to a contractor to build. And that contractor executed those plans. That backyard had substantial fill placed in it. It ultimately failed and did extensive damage to the next door neighbor's house and yard. And had it not been for the fact that they were away from home the day that the landslide occurred, it would have injured someone because it went right through one of the children's bedrooms. And what caused that was they'd failed to specify that a soil investigation be conducted. They'd failed to specify the right kind of soil to be placed. They'd failed to specify the right compaction rates for that soil. They'd failed to specify the slope gradient that was required at a level that was sustainable. And they'd failed to provide any drainage system on the site. And then on top of that, designed an irrigation system that was oversized. As a consequence, what happened, and this was not in a flooding condition, the irrigation system overwatered an under-stabilized soil, it supercharged with the water, and then just collapsed. And so there were literally 15 or 20 claims based on the design of that project, and that was just one instance. And so this is intended to help preclude that from happening anymore. For me personally, it means maybe a little less expert witness testimony. So there's a ding to me, but the benefit to the public is that these claims go away for the most part because people who are qualified, then the consumers know because they have gone through the process of getting registered.
If I might follow up. I can appreciate your position. I think all of us who are involved in private business have renegades in our own business. In looking at the bill, it's no small change to the way we do business. And there's got to be, I would think, a certain amount of buyer beware in every project that occurs. But I'm just wondering if, in your estimation, if we have had only a half dozen allegations of problems here in the last, and I'm not sure what the time period may be, but we've only had a half dozen allegations of problems within your profession. I'm wondering if going through this kind of effort to develop this mechanism and so forth is worth doing that to the general public. And that is an honest question.
Mm-hmm. If I might respond to that, Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I think two things. One, when Jim Figurski was mentioning the six that he's aware of, these were people that actually requested a claim for the board. Didn't include the numbers of people that either called and were told we don't deal with practice or who just didn't call.
In addition to that, the claims that I've personally dealt with involving expert witness, arbitration, and third-party claims have all been dealt with in a different environment. And I am literally a scratch on the back of this issue. Most of that kind of work is dealt with by many other people. And on a national level, what over 20 states have found is that, and it's growing all the time, is that for the public safety's sake, this extends beyond the typical buyer beware scenario, because there's no way for the public to be assured that what somebody says is actually true, absent some sort of certification process that you've actually, that the state can provide a consumer with. And so there's a huge amount of unrecorded problems that extends way beyond what we experienced in the few cases I've dealt with. And most I've dealt with have been people who have had huge amounts of resources to go to court. So the majority of people, as I know, my friends, I certainly couldn't afford to take something to court.
If I might follow up one
follow up.
Then it would be fair to say then that your industry is truly plagued by a severe problem in here.
Well, what I would say is, if I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Wilson, I would not characterize it as plagued by this. What I would say is that for the most part, those who are registered, which is approximately 350 landscape architects in the state of Oregon, this is not an issue. Because while the Practice Act currently doesn't exist in word, in order to become registered, even in the state of Oregon on a title act, you've got to go through all the education, training, and testing that gets you to that point. What this really deals with is a clarification for the consumers, for the contracting industry, and for the design community about where the line is drawn that engages people in non-threatening versus threatening acts in the public's health.
If I may follow up just a little bit in, as well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wilson, perhaps getting back to your question as well, the approximately six incidents that I had mentioned took place over, I've been on the board 7 years, a tenure of about 7 years, a little bit more now. So that's, it's about one a year. Most of those, as Mr. Morris has indicated, were not complaints involving landscape architects. Or landscape architects registered in the state of Oregon. And as you said, I mean, the intent is we're not as concerned with those who are identified to us already as licensed landscape architects. What we are concerned about, and quite frankly, we're not concerned with a great deal of landscape designers who operate at a very professional level or landscape contractors who operate at a very professional level. We're concerned about those individuals and entities who don't operate at that professional level. And it only takes one incident to be a catastrophe. It only takes one incident where someone hires someone who isn't qualified to provide a planting on a hillside overlooking a school that causes a slide, that causes an extreme problem. And that person, you know, our board, that person would still be able to go on and do design. There would be nothing to prevent them, other than reputation perhaps, depending upon how long people's memories are, to prevent that individual from going on and continuing to do the same sort of thing in other situations. We would hope that this would allow us to catch people before situations like that develop. And I would say one instance is probably too many. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. One question is in regard to Section 5, which lays out the exemptions. And I specifically wanted to, I'm thinking about a person's yard where they're arranging to have it landscaped and they're asking for the help of somebody who's a good garden designer. And my reading of, this is in line 27, it's capital B subsection where slopes of 10% or greater comprise 25% of the yard. If I have a yard that's perfectly flat over three quarters of the yard, and then has a very modest slope, a 1 to 10 slope is not a terribly steep slope, or the other quarter, my understanding is this person would have to hire
a landscape architect to design their yard. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I think the key to that is in that same, is in line 25, where it says native, you know, excuse me, let me get wrong line. It's line 29, where it says continuing 10% or greater comprise 25% of the total site area or directly contribute stormwater to natural drainage channels, streams, wetlands, marshes, or other sensitive natural areas regulated by local, state, or federal government. In the instance that you cited, it's unless that one-third of your yard with the 10% slope falls under a regulation, either local, state, or federal, then a landscape designer or anyone else would still be able to provide you with the type of design you needed. However, if there were regulations, specific regulations and codes that covered that particular slope or the implications of that slope or the watersheds that it contributed to, then someone would need to be aware of those regulations and would need to be responsive to those regulations, and you would want assurance of that individual's qualifications.
I'll just, Mr. Chair, can you follow up?
I'll
just note that if that's the intention, that the first clause applies only to areas regulated by local, state, or federal government.
Professional level. We're concerned about those individuals and entities who don't operate at that professional level. And it only takes one incident to be a catastrophe. It only takes one incident where someone hires someone who isn't qualified to provide a planting on a hillside overlooking a school that causes a slide, that causes an extreme problem. And that person, you know, our board, that person would still be able to go on and do design. There would be nothing to prevent them, other than reputation perhaps, depending upon how long people's memories are, to prevent that individual from going on and continuing to do the same sort of thing in other situations. We would hope that this would allow us to catch people before situations like that develop. And I would say one instance is probably too many. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. One question is in regard to Section 5, which lays out the exemptions. And I specifically wanted to, I'm thinking about a person's yard where they're arranging to have it landscaped and they're asking for the help of somebody who's a good garden designer. And my reading of, this is in line 27, it's capital B subsection where slopes of 10% or greater comprise 25% of the yard. If I have a yard that's perfectly flat over three quarters of the yard, and then has a very modest slope, a 1 to 10 slope is not a terribly steep slope, or the other quarter, my understanding is this person would have to hire a landscape architect to design their yard. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I think the key to that is in that same, is in line 25, where it says line 29, where it says continuing 10% or greater comprise 25% of the total site area or directly contribute stormwater to natural drainage channels, streams, wetlands, marshes, or other sensitive natural areas regulated by local, state, or federal government. In the instance that you cited, it's unless that one-third of your yard with the 10% slope falls under a regulation, either local, state, or federal, then a landscape designer or anyone else would still be able to provide you with the type of design you needed. However, if there were regulations, specific regulations and codes that covered that particular slope or the implications of that slope or the watersheds that it contributed to, then someone would need to be aware of those regulations and would need to be responsive to those regulations, and you would want assurance of that individual's qualifications.
I'll just, Mr. Chair, can you follow up? I'll just note that if that's the intention, that the first clause applies only to areas regulated by local, state, or federal government, that entire clause needs rewriting, because the way it reads as a series of three or either slopes of 10% or greater or directly contribute to stormwater or sensitive natural areas regulated by. And so it certainly isn't apparent that that's the intention of this clause. I'd like to ask you also about Section 19. You've noted that previously that what you had was a title act. Section 19 involves enforcement, and I assume what previously was enforced was that people did not use the title landscape architect inappropriately. But now we have before us a practice act, and so a great, much larger field of activity comes under the sanction penalties under Section 19. Essentially, as I read it, for example, if again I refer to my friendly neighborhood garden designer, specifies that there'll be 4 inches of concrete in the patio, and they're not an engineer, they may be liable to a civil penalty imposed by the board, and or any other practice that falls under the board, which is a wide scope, and the amount of the fines are increased up to $5,000. And moreover, the board under Section 20 is given the power to administer oaths, obtain and receive evidence, compel compliance with subpoenas. This sounds to me like we're setting up really a court, and I'm wondering if a citizen has the protections normally afforded in a court setting, and this seems rather extraordinary. I'd just like you to comment on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, this is standard boilerplate. This is not something that specifically applies to landscape architects and not to all the other licensing laws that we have in the state of Oregon for tax preparers and land surveyors and acupuncturists and other people. This is we didn't draft this. This was drafted by Legislative Council, and it's pretty much boilerplate language.
I mean, follow up, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. These amounts are the same amounts that currently exist in the engineering statutes, architectural statutes, and as Mr. Kafouri said, they are uniform, and that was the attempt again in changing the nature of the fines and the nature of the civil penalties, is to bring when we in instituting a practice act to bring it in line with the other professions and what they do, so there was no disparity, so that if we weren't saying, you know, that landscape architects are let off easier if they make mistakes than anyone else, or someone who impinges on this act is let off any easier than in any other infringement.
Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate an answer specifically to the question I asked, which was whether in this situation a person is afforded the same protection they would be afforded in a court. When, for example, you go for to have a traffic fine adjudicated, you have certain protections in your judicial proceeding. Does one receive those sort of protections in this setting?
You want to take it? You're the boss. I'll take it. You know it.
You want to start? No, I'll follow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, there's a thing called making a mountain out of a molehill. This is standard language. This is done across the board. I don't know. There may be 50 different licensing boards we have in the state of Oregon. They're all required to have the standards according to the State Administrative Procedures Act. This is nothing new that we're doing here. They're taking away rights of the citizens, especially for enforcing landscape architecture law. And we don't have special rules for landscape architect board that don't apply to all the other 50 or so licensing boards.
Let me interrupt you,
yeah.
if I may.
Yeah.
We're in a process of education here. I think the point was already made by your colleague that this is parallel to other boards. My question,
yeah. The answer is
has
yes.
Has to do with the protections afforded people when they go through this process.
The answer is that there are standard protections afforded under the Administrative Procedures Act for all administrative procedures, and they're not exactly the same as a court of law. No, they're broader. You have the right of hearsay, for example, that you can bring in. The strict rules of evidence that you have in a court of law don't apply. It's a much more informal process in a coming before a licensing board.
Thank you.
I think we probably covered that one.
Okay.
Representative Leonard, did you have a question?
I did. I'm just curious, currently, a person that is a landscape designer, do they need to be registered with the Construction Contractors Board?
Ken Cadell shakes his head no.
No. And what kind of registration, if any, do they require to?
Well, we'll have Ken up here, so
okay.
Let's wait on those questions for him.
Okay.
Any other questions? We do have about 7 witnesses to go, so. thank you.
Well, okay.
You have another one, Donna?
I'll wait. I'm sorry, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
We have some genuine bona fide.
I'm going to go work in my flowers for a while and I'll come back.
Not without a license, you won't.
Oh, that's right. Oh, no.
Settle down now.
Mr. Chair, bill is not scheduled for work session today. That the committee, let me offer to the committee that I may be happy to come myself or bring our folks to answer any questions in a lot more detail on an individual level if you'd like. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Kafoury. A comment just for your benefit as it regards Section 21 and the new members to the board. I would prefer that we have one more public member and that probably one less of those members would be landscape, architect landscape folks. So just for your benefit.
Mr. Chair, your wish is our command.
Just thought I'd mention that because I imagine if this goes forward, we're going to need some amendments. So, just for clarity's sake, I want to call Ken Cudell, and then we have several citizens here that want to testify. So, Ken, if you come up and maybe give us a brief synopsis. I know Representative Leonard has a question for you.
Ask about a contract.
Chair Knoop, members of the committee, my name is Ken Cudell. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board. Today I'm here to testify primarily as from a Landscape Contractor Board standpoint. We work with the landscape architects and with the landscape designer organizations, a number of people from both of those communities. In looking at the issue, those of you who this committee passed out a bill some time ago that exempted landscape designers from the Landscape Contractors Board regulation. And the reason we brought that bill to you, that was 2195. The reason we brought that bill to you was that our attorney had advised us that we had to start regulating landscape designers, that the words plan and install or any part thereof meant that landscape designers were supposed to be regulated by the Landscape Contractors Board. However, we found that they caused no damage. We don't have any consumer to protect from this. And so landscape architects were looking at doing some things with their bill. We jointly arrived at a definition of landscape designer that all of the landscape designers, Landscape Contractors Board, and the landscape architects could all live with. And that's how we end up with virtually the same definition in 2195 and in 2196. So today, Chair Representative Leonard, the answer to your question is the landscape designers are not are regulated by Construction Contractors Board. By law, they should be regulated by the Landscape Contractors Board. However, they are not. We've just not implemented that regulation.
Sure. Representative Leonard?
And if you did, that doesn't imply that the standards in 2196 would be applied. It just means that they would be registered as landscape designers. Is that what I understand you to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, they would be required to be licensed as a landscape contractor, and the work for our only landscape contracting business in order to do landscape design.
But, Mr. Chair, just so I'm clear, but that wouldn't mean that they would have to fit the definitions of 2196. You're saying that's current law and you just haven't been enforcing that.
That's correct. We didn't know we didn't know it was current law until just a few months ago.
I see. So, Mr. Chair, if I could follow that up. If we just administered the current interpretation of the law and did nothing else, we would be bringing into fold landscape designers in terms of regulating their activities more than what we are now.
Chair, Rep. Sam Leonard, that is correct. They would have to pass an examination and would have to meet certain standards.
And follow up, please.
Yes.
And the examination would be an examination that is general in nature in terms of responsibilities of a business owner or specific to the landscape design business.
Chair, Representative Leonard, the examination is on a number of subjects, plant, material, drainage, the technical end of it, parts of it, a smaller part of it is on the business operation, but most of it is on plant materials, the drainage, the soil, all of those things that a landscape contractor and anybody dealing with this should know, have some knowledge of.
Any other questions for Mr. Kudale?
We do have a concern with the bill, a couple of concerns, and we propose some amendments to the bill to make sure the first two amendments that I've shown are to make sure that because we have this thing called landscape contractor and then landscape business, we want to make sure that wherever it says landscape contractor, we also say landscape business. And the other one is, you'll hear testimony from an individual a little later, that some landscape contractors would like to use the term landscape design. So on page 2, line 31, where it says you can use the term landscape design if you put this disclaimer, this information. We want to be able to say that a landscape contractor or landscape business can also use that without having to put that disclaimer on it, because they can do it now. So the bill, it doesn't put further restrictions on the landscape contractor or a landscape a business, and it doesn't put any restriction or take away any thing from a licensed construction contractor. There's also some provision in there because construction contractors can do a certain amount of landscape contracting work.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Chairman Canope. Mr. Cadell, do you understand, help me understand, I'm sure you do understand, why we have so greatly expanded operation. I mean, we're now into operating an architect's business rather than speaking to the title. I guess I'll go back to that. That's where I started from originally. And I'm not sure why we're doing this, you know, which is why initially I said, you know, we're back to going into a practice versus title. This is really has become a judiciary issue. I mean, we're even into whistleblowing or, you know, in this document. I'm not sure. I don't understand this from when previously we discussed landscape designer.
Church, no, but why we're Nelson,
getting so...
Well, I can't speak to the bill from that standpoint, but what I think my best explanation of right now, you can do what the definition of landscape architect is so long as you don't call yourself one. And if we had that same sort of thing in the construction industry, you could act as a construction contractor as long as you don't call yourself a construction contractor. We would have a hard time enforcing anything in the construction industry. I think that's what the landscape architects have. Excuse me. in this instance, you can do the work of a landscape architect, just don't call yourself one, and you haven't violated any laws. With this will say you can't call yourself a landscape architect, and you can't do the work of a landscape architect unless you are one. That's the way I would define what this bill does. But I'm not the one to speak to that issue. I think the people who are sponsoring this bill. But it would be difficult for me to have any enforcement program for construction contractors if we were faced with the same thing that landscape architects have today. A bill that says you can't call yourself a landscape architect, but you can do the work of a landscape architect.
Mr. Chair. Continue?
Well, actually, I don't want to continue with Mr. Cadell right now because we have several citizens who come to testify, and we have two other bills. So let's see if we can get some more information from our witnesses, and then maybe they'll answer some of the questions you're thinking about asking. And if they don't, we'll try to get to those.
Don't leave, Mr. Cadell.
Okay. I'm going to call, is it Wendy Kroger? Please tell us who you are and where you're from and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Wendy Kroger and I live in Salem. And I'm just a community volunteer. I don't claim to be a landscape architect. I come here today not necessarily to speak against this proposal, but I am concerned about a portion of it. And the portion I'm concerned about has been alluded to by several of the people above the dais here, and that is the landscape designer. The designer appears to be the person who's getting caught in the middle and dropped, I guess, through the cracks, or squashed, I'm not sure which. One of the concerns I have is that, I guess from my perspective, I'm a consumer of landscape design and consultant services, and I'm that as a volunteer in the community who works as a watershed restoration and enhancement person. And so I work with school kids, I work with other folks like myself in terms of stream enhancement in Salem. And I work with a lot of students. I guess in my experience, in some of the restoration projects that I've been involved in, and I've had the opportunity to work in about 5 years' worth, designers that I've had an opportunity to work with have been very good on the ground. And that's important to us because a design concept is a great idea. Something on a piece of paper is very pretty. But when you get to the stream side and when you get to 50 feet back from a riparian area, which maybe was flooded last year, that changed between the time it got drawn on and the time you went out to the field, you have to have somebody who can make sense of that on the ground. And the designers with whom I have worked have been able to do that. That is not to cast any aspersions on landscape architects. I've had the opportunity to work with them in larger projects, and they're excellent also. But I don't want the designers to get lost here because they didn't have 5 or 6 years of school. If they have the opportunity to be licensed, and we only work with licensed, bonded, and insured designers, if they have the opportunity to do that and to be a contractor and to know infrastructure, it seems to me that we should use their services and we should be able to allow them to continue to work. So that is my biggest concern, is that I don't believe that the proposal currently, as it reads, is clear that landscape contractors can continue to perform design, or that folks, if they do perform design, aren't going to be required to be landscape architects. I guess it's a concern to me because I don't want to exclude the use of designers in natural areas, and I also am concerned, I've lobbied actively with the City of Salem to include in their new erosion control statutes locally to include licensed designers as well as certified professionals in erosion and sediment control. These people are not necessarily landscape architects, but they are very competent. So rather than excluding, I would rather include. Watershed councils are built as volunteers from the ground up. We try to include. We try to include a lot of different kinds of people. And that's the concern I have, is not to exclude, but to include. I think the final piece is that Currently, the City of Salem has a restoration plan requirement now for any work that's being done along streamside channels. It does not currently require the services of an architect, a landscape architect. If it did, the costs would be much, much higher, and it would take a lot longer to do these. So instead of having a way to have your citizens involved in working on the ground, doing things like restoration or enhancement, we have to go through a humpty dump hoops to get there. I'm not saying that there aren't serious considerations for things like slope, soil type, where the water goes. All those are very important, but the designers that we've worked with know who to go to get that kind of help. And I would rather have us include than exclude, and that's my concern. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Libby Layton.
Hi, I'm Libby Layton. I'm from the Portland area, and I'm better in front of a stand of trees than people I don't know when it comes to speaking, but I'll do the best I can. I'm a member of the American Professional Landscape Designers. It's a national organization. It's 11 years old. It's not well known around the country yet. Those of us who belong to it know it. We wish the public knew it, and we're trying to get that information out as fast as a fledgling organization can do. We have a certification process. I am a certified landscape designer in Oregon. It is national, not state. There are four or five of us right now. I personally support the bill that's up in front of you. I don't do the work landscape architects do. I'm frightened of doing something that might affect public safety. I don't have the training to do some of the wonderful things you saw on the screen a little while ago. I admire it and love it, and I'm happy for the work that I do have and that I do do. I do have a degree in fine arts and later went back to college and got a second degree with a major in landscape architecture when I couldn't support myself painting poor paintings. So I'm strongly grounded in an art background. I think at the moment there's an enormous amount of confusion in the public between architects, designers, and landscape contractors. I know there is. People tend to call me a landscape architect. I have been working in Oregon since 1975, so the assumption is I must be a landscape architect. I'm not, and I clear it up right away. I only do private residences. That's the only kind of work I do. Let me look at this. Because the public is confused, people are often hired to do the wrong thing. And as a responsible designer, I have to say to a client, I don't do that. I'm afraid that slope might slough off. There might be trouble down there on that sidewalk or that street below that, and I'm not qualified to do that, but I'll tell you who will do it. And I can work with a geotech engineer. I can help you with the design aspect, but I want the structure to be signed off with someone with that stamp. And I think that's the responsible approach as a landscape designer. And responsible people do work that way. Unfortunately, not everyone does. And I'm often called in to a job that has been done and done rather badly and asked, how can I make this better? And I'm not talking now about structure. I've changed my slant. I'm sorry. It's nervousness. But maybe aesthetically, it wasn't done quite right. It turns out that a landscape contractor without any training in design, but some years behind a shovel and or a backhoe, has suddenly announced that that person is a designer and is going to design a yard and doesn't understand what goes into a good design. So this is a problem for us. We have a problem both ways as landscape designers. We're not qualified for landscape architecture work. We are overqualified in design for landscape contractors' work. Now, we're not necessarily overqualified in what landscape contractors do. I think it would be wonderful if there were a state certification program for us so that the public could be cleared up on the issues. I'm not sure how it should be done because of this reason. We don't run the kind of business that a landscape contractor does unless we have a design build firm. Now, a lot of us don't. A lot of us are designers. In a way, it's no different than painting a painting and selling it to someone. We paint the painting, and then instead of going to an agent to sell the painting, we put our design out for bid to the landscape contractors, and maybe we supervise the work a bit, and maybe we don't. But that's the way those of us who are only designers, not contractors, operate. So if we were called to take a landscape contractor's exam, we would have some trouble on some aspects of it, I do believe. I also believe that as it is now set up, it would not reflect our expertise in design and in knowledge of plant material and knowledge of all the things that makes garden art a fine art. Now, if the landscape contractor's exam were to reflect the things that we know personally, the landscape contractors would have a very difficult time because it's not their training. So at the moment, I don't know, I don't think it's up to me to say how that could be addressed, but I do think that you should know that landscape contractors and landscape designers are completely different fields. I think designers should know how things are constructed because you can't design if you don't know how they're constructed. I also know that I want to turn to one of the people who does my work and say, I know there are new irrigation heads, and I know I haven't been keeping up on it. Can you please fill in the blanks? Or, I haven't dealt with this kind of drainage. What is that new kind of pipe everyone's talking about that I haven't learned about yet? I count on them for that. I don't know all those things. I try to learn them as I go along, so the next time. I think I'm very typical, the point is. So, I thank you very much for giving me this chance to talk about the difference between landscape contractors and landscape designers. And again, I do want to point out that I'm not against state certifications, especially until APLD is well known. But I don't think that we should be looked at as landscape contractors. I don't mind being regulated by them as long as it's understood that we are entirely different. And again, I'm not talking about design build firms. They're different also. So we have these different categories, and it's no wonder the public is very confused about this. Very confused about this. But some years behind a shovel and or a backhoe has suddenly announced that that person is a designer and is going to design a yard and doesn't understand what goes into a good design. So this is a problem for us. We have a problem both ways as landscape designers. We're not qualified for landscape architecture work. We are overqualified in design for landscape contractors' work. Now, we're not necessarily overqualified in what landscape contractors do. I think it would be wonderful if there were a state certification program for us so that the public could be cleared up on the issues. I'm not sure how it should be done because of this reason. We don't run the kind of business that a landscape contractor does unless we have a design build firm. Now, a lot of us don't. A lot of us are designers. In a way, it's no different than painting a painting and selling it to someone. We paint the painting, and then instead of going through an agent to sell the painting, we put our design out for bid to the landscape contractors, and maybe we supervise the work a bit, and maybe we don't. But that's the way those of us who are only designers, not contractors, operate. So if we were called to take a landscape contractor's exam, we would have some trouble on some aspects of it, I do believe. I also believe that as it is now set up, it would not reflect our expertise in design and in knowledge of plant material and knowledge of all the things that makes garden art a fine art. Now, if the landscape contractor's exam were to reflect the things that we know personally, the landscape contractors would have a very difficult time because it's not their training. So at the moment, I don't know. I don't think it's up to me to say how that could be addressed, but I do think that you should know that landscape contractors and landscape designers are completely different fields. I think designers should know how things are constructed because you can't design if you don't know how they're constructed. I also know that I want to turn to one of the people who does my work and say, I know they're new irrigation heads, and I know I haven't been keeping up on it. Can you please fill in the blanks? Or I haven't dealt with this kind of drainage. What is that new kind of pipe everyone's talking about that I haven't learned about yet? I count on them for that. I don't know all those things. I try to learn them as I go along, so the next time I think I'm very typical, the point is. So I thank you very much for giving me this chance to talk about the difference between landscape contractors and landscape designers. And again, I do want to point out that I'm not against state certification, especially until APLD is well known. But I don't think that we should be looked at as landscape contractors. I don't mind being regulated by them as long as it's understood that we are entirely different. And again, I'm not talking about design build firms. They're different also. So we have these different categories, and it's no wonder the public is very confused about this. Very confused about this. I get phone calls saying, do you build rock walls? I don't build rock walls. I get lift rocks. You know, that's the trouble.
Thank you, Libby. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to keep moving down our witness list just so we have a chance for all the citizens who've come today to testify. Bonnie Lowe. Lux. We had two people that were sure it was going to be Lowe, so... L-A-U-X.
Majority.
Lux, yeah?
People,
yeah. Well, thank you, Bonnie.
Sure. Thank you for letting me come speak with you today. I'm a new landscape designer. I'm not a contractor. I'm not a landscape architect. And I've completed a two-year program in horticulture and landscape design at Clackamas Community College. Prior to making this career shift, I was a lawyer and practiced law in Oregon for 13 years, and I'm a member of the bar now. And because of that experience, I'm well aware of the confusion that can come from statutes that are poorly defined or not defined at all. And as a new designer, I was curious about the legal status of designers and legislation, and it was quite a surprise to find out that all this was going on in the legislature, and it didn't do much to clarify things for me. I am a member of the Association of Professional Landscape Designers that Libby Layton just testified about, and I know that organization supports this bill, and I support it also in as much as it allows landscape designers to continue practicing without having to become landscape architects. However, I have concerns about the language and some of the terms that are used. I was somewhat reassured by Jim Fugerski's testimony that this bill is not intended to limit what landscape designers can do. However, I think the way it's written, it does limit it, or could certainly be construed to limit it. And I'm referring specifically to Section 5, Subsection F. And I'm afraid I don't have the copy everyone else has with line numbers on it. I got mine off the internet. And it says this bill does not restrict or otherwise affect the right of any person to engage in making conceptual plans or drawings for the selection, general placement, or use of plants or other site features. And then it goes on with some other exceptions. When I first read that, I thought, well, what exactly does that mean? Conceptual plans or drawings? And does conceptual modify drawings as well as plans? General placement or use of plants? You know, designers do very specific plant placement. They do planting plans. They tell you what plant to put where, what size. And so it seems to me, after reading through this a number of times, that I think the problem is really one. I think this language is more general and a little bit more ambiguous than what is intended. Mr. Fugerski's explanation seemed very clear to me, and he was able to draw a line as to what's conceptual and what's not conceptual. But that's not defined in the statute anywhere, and I think people could have different interpretations of that. And I'd like that to be cleared up to be consistent with what his testimony was. And I gave you some written testimony, and I'd like to add one thing to that, or two things really, that came up in response to Representative Merkley's testimony, questions earlier about the... in subsection B, where it talks about slopes of 10% or greater, and someone from the architects or landscape architects group that was up here testified that all of the clauses in there are modified by, regulated by state, local, or federal government. And I have to agree with Representative Merkley's assessment that, all those clauses in there are not modified by that phrase. And the way it reads right now, a designer could not work on a lot that had a slope greater than 10% on at least 25% of the property. And that's not that much of a slope. I think there's a similar problem with the first subsection where there's, I hope I'm not being too confusing, but there's also a clause in there that says regulated by local, state, or federal government. And I don't know if that is supposed to apply to all the kinds of things listed there, all natural drainage channels, streams, or wetlands, or does the regulated by local, state, or federal government only apply to other sensitive natural areas? So I think this language is open to a lot of interpretation, and I think it's confusing, and I don't think it really clarifies what designers can do as distinguished from architects, and will only lead to yet more confusion. And as you can probably figure out from other testimony today, there's already a lot of confusion about what designers can do. Thank you.
Thank you. If you're here specifically for 2759, we'll disappoint you also. We won't be hearing that bill today. Liz Francis and Steve Cravenhoff.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Knopp. Is it Knopp or?
Knope.
Knope. Sorry.
It's all right.
My name is Liz Francis. I'm a licensed landscape contractor. I put myself out in the public on the marketplace as a licensed landscape designer. The function of my work is landscape design. As a licensed landscape contractor, I have the freedom and choice to be able to function either as a contractor or a designer. This is part of a path that I started in 1994 when I called the Landscape Contractors Board. I remember the call specifically, and I have to disagree that they were not enforcing landscape designers, because I was told specifically if I wanted to practice landscape design, I had better get a license to do that with the Landscape Contractors Board. I then spent the next 5 years preparing to take the landscape contractor's examination through a lengthy intern with the landscape installer, where I learned just about everything you could possibly learn about landscape design and landscape contracting. I then prepared myself for the examination and took the examination, and I was very thankful that I had the opportunity to do that. And I must say, as a designer, and I think I'm a pretty good one because I'm pretty busy, that the examination is very well suited to landscape design. Because you need to understand construction of landscapes very well to be able to specify landscaping, it should be a minimum requirement for all landscape designers to be able to take this test and show competency in the trade. The other thing is, one of the previous speakers spoke about not knowing certain things in landscape construction and relying on the landscape contractor to fill in the blanks. Many of my customers do not hire a landscape contractor. They do their own work. They need good advice. They need to know about things like how much underlayment goes under the brick, what kind of brick, you know, how do I dig this out, do I need to compact it. They need to know things like that if they're going to do their own construction. So a minimum competency is necessary in construction. I also must say that construction is art when it's done well. So to me, the idea of separating art from construction is completely ridiculous. None of my clients in 7 years have ever asked me to develop a concept or a planting plan. I believe this legislation could potentially put me out of work. If it's confusing to the customer about what my role is, and if they're a group of people that can afford my services. It's a very closed network of people. And they talk to each other quite a bit. And if someone has a bad experience such that they find out because they need a 2-foot retaining wall on their project, which also requires the services of a landscape architect or another professional, they will have a bad experience and talk about that. And so landscape designers or anybody who's called a landscape designer could potentially lose business. I'm really concerned about that confusion. I also agree with some of the other previous speakers about the state of confusion. I do have the situation, even though I advertise under landscape design in the phone book, people always call up and ask for an irrigation system or something like that. But I do try to connect those people with, I feel, qualified contractors to provide that service. But I also want to know what's going on with irrigation systems. I also want to know, what is appropriate to be specifying on things like, I don't really specify irrigation, but I specify everything else in a landscape, pretty much. I also am concerned that we may be limited in the future, including landscape contractors, to be able to design spaces such as sensitive areas, drainage areas, bioswales, wetlands areas, riparian zones. These are areas that I feel this is a huge target market. In the future, it's going to be more and more important. People are looking for sustainability, and working with native plant materials is really important in my business. And I don't want to be excluded from being able to do that work for any reason. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any short questions for Liz? Thank you, Liz. I appreciate you coming today. Liz has extensive testimony. I hope all the committee members got that. And she actually has some specifics in here about how this potentially affects her business. Is Steve Cravenhoe here? Steve, come on up. We've got just a couple minutes left here on this bill.
Hi, Chairman Knopp and reps. My name is Steve Cravino. I've been in business 21 years. I'm a contractor, landscape contractor. My target market is individuals who want a good quality job done, but they're concerned about how much money they spend. So they call me up and they say, listen, this is what I have in mind. This is what I want to do. What's the most effective way of pulling this one off? Well, after 21 years experience, I'm able to give them some advice and recommend them to different people who do landscape designing. I have had the experience of working with people who supply me with a design that they got from somebody, and I look at it and I just shake my head and I go, this isn't, after 21 years of doing business, I don't think this is going to cut it. We better run it by someone that really knows what's going on. So I'll recommend them to a licensed landscape designer, and between the landscape designer and me and a homeowner, unless an architect is required, okay, and I know how far I can go, we put the whole job together and the customer gets a fine job. It's done right. Their landscape's not sliding down a hill. It's just this bill, 2196, is just too confusing for me. And just the way it's worded, it makes part of it looks good, but then you read down, and part of it looks bad. And I just don't like the feel that I get from this. And I'm representing a lot of guys in the state of Oregon to do maybe $200,000 a year or less. I'm the small businessman. I got 2 employees, okay? 3 in the summer on a good year. But it's just very important for me to make sure that the designers that are licensed and bonded and insured don't get screwed over. Excuse me. Don't.
We understand that.
You know what I'm saying?
We get that.
Got it.
Right? No, the other thing I wanted to say was that it affects how much money the overall cost of the project is going to be. Okay? You have to hire an architect, it's going to cost so much more. I mean, Just one other thing here. And I don't want to lose my right to be a landscape designer in the future. It appears to me that this is just a piece. They take a little piece here, and they take a little piece there, and they take it. And before you know it, you know, where am I? I'm backed up against a corner. I've broken my leg. I can't go out and work out in the field with my crew. And so my option would be I could design my own, you know, but it seems to me that if they keep pushing and pushing and pushing, they're going to put me into a corner and the landscape designers into a corner, and they're going to control more than what I would like to see them control. And that's all I have to say. I appreciate your time.
Thank you
Any
very
questions?
Much.
Any questions?
We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bill Cross, this would be speed testimony, 60 seconds or less.
Chair Canope, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm representing the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and we would simply urge the committee to consider the language offered by the Landscape Contractors Board that Ken Cadell submitted earlier that would clarify that the those landscape contractors licensed and regulated by the Oregon Landscape Contract Board and their landscape business activities regulated by that board would be exempt then from this this board. We already have sufficient regulatory licensing established for the landscape contractors. So we believe the language already recommended would clarify that the landscape contractors and their businesses would be exempt from this proposal.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
No one else on the witness list, and I wish I had time. I'm not even going to ask if anybody else wants to testify on the bill, because I'm afraid there would be someone. We need to get on to another bill, which I know there are citizens here to testify on. And so I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2196. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2084. And is Gary here?
Yeah. Where is Gary?
There he is. Yeah. Gary, come on up.
What, 2084?
2084. Mm-hmm. You can testify on this with me on my sheet. Gary, you're going to testify a little bit on this, or do you have some other folks that want to do it? Yeah, if you just make a few opening comments, and then we'll head down the list.
For the record, my name is Gary Pello. This bill is being presented because of a weakness that a group of us found in a situation that Senator Test in a letter presented to each committee member. The weakness is that the current statute, 243.303, does not make it clear that a group of retirees in local government cannot be separated. And so we've added the language, we are attempting to add the language that says that group of retirees cannot be separated. And Doug McKean from Legislative Council will be testifying in a minute about some language. The last sentence or two in the proposed changes came out with an unintended consequence, and he'll address that. And we're still working on that, and following his testimony, maybe you'll have some questions of him of what that language should be. Because the intent is to have premiums for those retired employees that are roughly equal to the premiums being experienced by the active staff. But there is a difference there, and I'll let Doug address that.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Doug, are you here? Doug McKean?
Chairman Knope and members of the committee, my name is Doug McKean with Legislative Council. The language that Gary was talking about is on page 2 of the bill, and it's in subsection 3, paragraph B. I'll back up a little bit. Paragraph A pretty much says that a local government and a health insurer that they can't treat a group of retired employees differently than they treat their active employees, and they provide coverage. Paragraph B says that they can't charge a higher premium to that group of retired employees than they charge to the active employees. What Gary has asked, or Representative Backlund has asked, is that we take out paragraph B and add in some language that talks about some employers and their insurers will create a three-tier system that have the member, member and spouse, member and family. And if they're charging that kind of three-tier system to their active employees, the retired employees should be able to use that same three-tiered system so that the retired employee pays, if it's just a single employee, pays the single rate and not a composite rate. Some insurers will create a composite rate that applies to all the employees, and it's a composite of those three different groups. In the case of the retirees, if they have to pay that composite rate, more likely than not, that rate's going to be higher than if they were to pay the appropriate tiered rate. So we need to get some language in there that describes that three-tier system, describes that composite rate, and says that if the employer or the insurer is charging the three-tier system, then the retirees get to pay on the three-tier system. If the employer and the insurer are charging the active workers with a composite rate, the retirees would still be able to be charged on an appropriate tier in a three-tier system. So what I've done is I've contacted the insurance division and a fellow over there, Lou Littlehales, is going to work with me and come up with the right language. Insurance language is not my forte, so I need to use the right words. We're going to build that language, so we'll come back with an amendment, hopefully before your work session.
Thank you. Any questions for Legislative Council? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Brown?
Chair Canope, members of the committee, my name's Jim Brown. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Salem, office at 214 Pioneer Trust Building. I'm appearing solely on my own behalf in this matter. My practice has involved representing employees of local government from time to time, typically senior management, administrators in school districts, and that sort of thing. I have found from time to time there are situations in which some employers, school districts, offer early retirement incentives. Those have a public purpose in that they tend to create stability. If you work, for example, 10 or 15 years for a district, then you qualify for an early retirement benefit. The other thing it does is it allows a district to give an incentive to retire folks off the upper ends of the salary scale. So it's a workable thing. One of the aspects of early retirements is qualification for the group health insurance. And when people make those decisions, I've found that it's very important to know what you're going to be eligible for. And if the ground rules change, as they have from time to time, I have one situation going right now where there's a difference of about $700 a month from what the expectation was to what the retiree is actually paying. So to the extent, it does appear that the measure would pin this down and make this very clear what that entitlement is, and I think that serves the public interest. So thank you very much. Most of the questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Brown? Thank you, Mr. Brown. Lori Wimmer-Wayman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2084 on behalf of my organization. As it turns out, we were one of the original sponsors and promoters of the bill that created the statute that's now being amended. And so, of course, we would see it, any clarification to that statute is entirely appropriate. I really don't have anything more to add, and I won't waste your time unless you have questions.
Any questions? No? Thank you. Let's see. Anyone else wishing to testify? We had several other names on here that were crossed off. Do they not want to testify anymore? No? Okay.
Well, that's it on our witnesses, and we're waiting for
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leonard.
What's our current policy on conceptual amendments?
We are not real interested in conceptual amendments. I think the first chair to do that was yesterday. I don't want to be the second.
Oh, okay.
I almost was let down that path a couple days ago, Representative Leonard. I don't know if you were here, but
no, I wasn't.
I was close.
But I'm a strong supporter in general of Representative Backlund's concepts, but this in particular. So
well,
I'd like to move her forthwith.
And I think we can do that if we get amendments.
Okay.
And so we're going to wait on legislative council. I think there's some legalese here that needs to be put into this bill, and I'm not sure that we could do it conceptually.
Okay.
Nor should we. So your support is duly noted, and we'll bring it back when we have it in good shape. No one else wishing to testify? Thank you much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2084, and we will adjourn committee.